Today's show is sponsored by Talkspace, the online therapy company. For a fraction of the price of traditional therapy, you can pick an experienced, licensed therapist you relate to and feel comfortable with. Each and every therapist has at least a master's degree and has completed over 3,000 hours of supervised work. To match with your perfect therapist, go to Talkspace.com/boom. And to show your support for this podcast, use code BOOM to get $30 off your first month. That's BOOM, Talkspace.com/boom, B-O-O-M.
Welcome to The Heat Check. I'm Wes Goldberg, editor of AllYouCanHeat.com and writer at Fansided. With me, as always, it's David Rommel. How are you doing, David?
Doing pretty good, man. Good first week of basketball.
It was a very good this season's been very good. I got a little worried before the year that it was going to be like the season of injuries with Paul George and Durant and now Westbrook, and the whole Thunder team is like a pickup squad or something. And this, but the games have been really, really awesome, and I can only imagine how much better this season would be so far after like a couple weeks than like if Paul George was playing and the Pacers were like relevant, and if Durant and Westbrook were doing their thing over in Oklahoma. Just, I've been really excited to watch a lot of these games.
Yeah, and it's funny because a lot of players and media types are always complaining about the length of the preseason and everything else, but it may have actually worked, and maybe it's just kind of a different side of the whole LeBron effect of him going to Cleveland, but it seems like the league is much more wide open. There's no clear-cut favorite there because the Cavs are struggling, the Spurs are a little bit older, mm-hmm. and it doesn't look like there are as many teams that are, you know, strong contenders. It looks like a lot of teams can actually be in title contention, so it should be an exciting year, and I think you're right. I mean, the level of play has been much better than expected. You know, early in the season, at least I remember this being, you know, the case, you know, over the last few years, you know, a lot of teams struggled right out the gate, and they weren't scoring as effectively. It doesn't seem to be the case this time around. So it started off well. We can only hope it continues throughout the whole season.
I've been disappointing with the Clippers. They were my I did a predictions piece over at Fansided with a bunch of different writers, and I was the only one to pick the Clippers to win the NBA championship, and I really did not feel good about it. But I just thought, like, why not? Like, I'm just going to pick them because – and I don't even like the Clippers, like, as a team. Like, I'm just like, I don't know if they have, like, the paint defense in the long run, or if they're, like, I don't know. I don't even really know why I picked them, and now I feel like an idiot because they're, like, not... I mean, they're, like, what, 3-2? So they're not, like, horrible, but they just don't look right. And I really like the Warriors, and I kind of wanted to pick the Warriors, and I should have just picked the Warriors because they look amazing.
Yeah, it's funny because, I mean, there are so many teams that are kind of, like, waffling around there in the middle of the pack. And you never know who's going to pull out from that, but clearly the Warriors are one of those teams. I'm still on the fence. Like, every time I see them, you know, they've got this great defense. They've got incredible offensive potential that can be, you know, realized on any given night. But I can't shake the feeling that, well, it's the Warriors. They're never going to make it. You know, they haven't been relevant, not really, as title contenders for, you know, 40 years. So it's kind of hard. It's kind of hard to think of them as being, you know, actual legitimate contenders, but there are so many good teams out there. I'm actually torn. Aside from my loyalties to Miami or whatever, I've always thought that maybe Oklahoma City would finally, you know, put it all together this year. With the injuries, I'm still not sure whether or not they're going to be a legitimate threat.
I'm so anti-Thunder.
You don't see them making it?
Not unless they want to. They got to start trading those guys, like Perry Jones. I mean, he got hurt, but like Perry Jones and Andre Roberts and, like, even guy like Reggie Jackson, who they can get a lot for. I'm like, you trade James Harden and you just get more, like, draft picks and stockpile assets and Kevin Martin, apparently. And, you know, you don't really, like, trade those guys for, like legit, like, veteran guys. Like, Danny Granger would have been a good fit for them. Or, like, you know, he hasn't played this year, but, like, a guy like that, just a guy that's been there and done that, they need those guys to come off the bench, not more young guys. They drafted their young guys. They had Ibaka, Durant. They hit with Westbrook. They hit with all those guys. They let one of them go. They let Harden go. I mean, just you got your core. Just start building around them and get rid of Kendrick Perkins, for God's sake. Like, easier said than done, I know. But, like, they could go out and sign guys. Like, their big signing was Anthony Morrow. Like, what the hell is that? Like, go get somebody. There's so many guys out there that they could have went out after. But I really like the Warriors. I think it's all about Bogut, and I really think they need to start putting bringing David Lee off the bench. I think that's going to be huge for the playoffs. Those are the two things, is Bogut staying healthy and eventually deciding that David Lee needs to come off the bench and just playing Draymond Green or Harrison Barnes as a stretch four. I think those are the two things that they have to do.
Yeah. just lost my train of thought there real quickly, but I also thought that the Mavericks were going to be a real solid contender. I think they look like a very good team so far this season, and I think they're going to be very dangerous. They have that right mix there, so it seems like a good mix.
I really like the Mavericks. And did you watch any of that Utah Jazz Cavs game last night when Gordon Hayward hit the game winner?
Absolutely.
I watched the whole thing on replay. What's that?
I just caught the fourth quarter, and it was a very good... the way that the Cavs had come back into it made it interesting, and then for Hayward to hit that game winner, that was... they look like they're a pretty solid team also, and the Cavs, clearly they have some glaring weaknesses to take care of, but...
Hayward's always had good games against LeBron. Remember, like, in Miami, he always would have a good game against LeBron. I mean, this isn't new. I always felt like he always played well.
I can't recall. I mean, I can't get past Miami's loss to Utah last season during that six-game road trip where that was supposed to be the gimme matchup. They went up against the Clippers, the Warriors, the Suns, the Mavs, and the Thunder, and the one loss they had in six games was to Utah Jazz. So
I've been a big Gordon Hayward fan since Butler, so I've been following him his entire career. I know it's kind of a weird thing, but it's true.
No, I mean, he's a nice player. Do you think he deserves the big contract? I mean, I know that's a big issue. But...
Yeah, why not, right? I mean, it's so hard to tell with the cap going up. Like, they had to give it to him or else somebody else was going to give it to him and they were going to steal him away. And they really view him as like an anchor in that team. And I think he's, without him, that whole, like, that's a really young roster. Like, I was watching the Jazz broadcast and... it's like 85% of their points have been scored by players 25 years or younger or something, like crazy, like some crazy stat. And it's like the second most is like the Magic at 75%. So they're like by far the youngest team in the NBA with like invested in young guys, you know? And that's like a crazy stat. But I feel like without Hayward, that whole thing just comes undone. Like they have no identity. They don't know what they're doing. But they played this five-out system. It was like, you hear about the five out and the spread the floor and pace and space and 3-point shooting all the time, but they literally play with five guys on the 3-point line. Like they got away with it. They got away from it a little bit in the second half, but in that first half, Quinn Snyder, I mean, it was five guys and Enes Kanter is like hitting corner threes, and it was like, I'm gonna watch a lot more Jazz this season. That's for sure.
Yeah, you got me interested. I'm gonna try and look them up as well because I didn't see that when I was watching them, but that sounds like an interesting.
Just go back and watch the first quarter. It's all just the first 5 minutes. That's all you need of that Cavs game. You'll just be like, holy crap, like this is a lot of fun to watch. I'm going to watch more of these guys. Because then you got like guys like Alec Burks and Trey Burke, and even Derek Favors is having a baller year. They're just like, they got so much space to do stuff, and it's awesome. But this is a Heat podcast, so we should probably talk about those guys.
Yeah, I was going to segue naturally from saying, well, what if Hayward had come to the Charlotte Hornets as, you know, he had signed the offer sheet there?
All right.
We had our hands full already with Lance Stephenson. So.
Right, and the Hornets played Miami last night, so I see where you're going with this. Good segue. Let's just go with that one. Let's pretend that's what we did.
Well, he certainly would have improved their shooting, I guess. And that was supposed to be a chance for Miami to bounce back after a disappointing loss to Houston on Tuesday. And instead, it was a perfect storm where guys that had been struggling to score finally started hitting their shots, and Miami's offense that had looked so great over the first few games of the season all of a sudden went stagnant. Shots that should have fallen rimmed out. You know, guys like Norris Cole, Chris Bosh, even Dwayne Wade had shots kind of fall in and out, and without that kind of production, it was just a really poor... I mean, we were still there. You know, what was it? Like, with a few minutes left in the fourth quarter, we were only down three, and there was a chance there for us to make the comeback complete. And it just didn't work out that way. Instead, we crumbled, and they found a way to hang on to their lead. So, disappointing two-game back-to-back set for Miami, I think.
You and I both had pieces come out this morning on allyoucanheat.com, which were critical. Yours was of the point guard play, specifically that of Norris Cole, which we'll get to in a second. And then mine was about how we basically have no answer for real big men.
Yeah.
And I thought that was interesting that we both took a negative approach, but you're right. Like the Heat almost stole that game. Like they had a couple opportunities. Like there's a few turnovers, like Bosh, like the ball just going off his hands late in the fourth, and just some defensive lapses and things like that. And ultimately, it was just it was just a tough game, and with a few breaks that just didn't, I think what Spoelstra just basically said, like, they basically played evenly, they just got all the hustle plays, and that was basically the difference. And I kind of, like, Spoelstra says a lot of things sometimes, but I kind of agreed with him in this sense. Like, that was almost exactly right. Like, they just seemed to, the ball was just bouncing their way all night, and sometimes they're going to have games like that. And we talked about this before the season in our ultimately depressing podcast, that episode, how there was going to be times where the ball movement just wasn't going to look good at all, and it was just going to be a struggle to score 90 points. And that's kind of what we had last night. And the Heat start 3-0, and then they drop two straight. They're going to have stretches like this. It's just the way it's going to be. And I think Heat fans have a lot more perspective now after, like, the last 4 years of, like, a drunken frat party with LeBron James here, and now we kind of come out of that haze and a little bit more perspective on things. So I don't really sense, like, that same kind of, like what's that word? Like, chaos or despair or anything that's going on. Like, everybody's like, okay, we lost two straight. Like, yeah, expectations aren't as high, but they're going to get right back into it. It's going to happen. It's going to be a struggle. They're going to be like this. We're going to go on three-game win streaks. We're going to go on three-game lose streaks. It's just going to happen throughout the year.
I feel like a lot of the buzz was coming nationally when people all of a sudden looked south and said, hey, wait a minute, they're one of, like, you know, four undefeated teams early on in the season. That's totally unexpected. And not just that, but then you follow it up with Chris Bosh winning Eastern Conference Player of the Week honors. And all of a sudden, hey, maybe this Miami team isn't, you know, much more dangerous than we had expected, even though they don't have LeBron James. And then what do? We fall flat, you know, two straight games. So you're right. I think maybe locally there might be more, for Heat fans, there might be more of a perspective. But nationally, I think now all of a sudden, you know, the up and down of the regular season, maybe now you start to write off Miami unless they can bounce back and have a signature win. I know it was a good win over Washington. Follow that up with, you know, an expected one over Philadelphia. And then on a back-to-back against Toronto, we pull out a victory there as well. So that was, you know, impressive. But we have to continue to build on that and not show the weaknesses that we did against Houston and Charlotte. I mean, there was just so much that we could have done better in both of those games. I think Houston was particularly demoralizing. Charlotte, you know, we should have won that one. So I don't know. Oh, maybe it's the other way around. Maybe Charlotte's more demoralizing, and the fact that Houston just completely, he just beat us down.
Houston was a better team. Houston's just a better basketball team, and, like, that just showed. They're just better. But let me be the optimist here. I think it's good that they lost. Maybe not both games, but I'm glad that they lost. Imagine if they were 6-0 right now, and everybody would be saying, or 5-0, right? 5-0.
Yeah.
Imagine, like, they didn't need LeBron. Like, they're undefeated. Are they the best team in the East? Are they title contenders? They didn't have this whole media circus again. Good thing they lost. Get it? We were 3-0, undefeated. Kind of got some tension that way. Oh, the Heat are actually pretty good. So they got their respect. You know, they were able to hold on to some of that respect. You know, nationwide. And now we lost, so we're out of the limelight again. And let's just keep our head down and keep plugging away and get into the playoffs. That's how I feel.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that that's a big thing. You know, they've always kind of mentioned that throughout the early preseason, everything else, that they liked being out of the limelight and just doing their work. It fits the model of the team and Spoelstra much more effectively, and that he's just workmanlike in his approach to the season. So I see your point. I wish that they had had a better showing against Houston, because I think there was a chance there for them. I had written it in my game preview where I think because of their contrasting styles, where we don't dominate the paint, it was a matter of which team was able to, you know, as cliche as it might sound, impose their will. And I think Houston just did so much of a better job at that. You know, maybe they got some incredible shooting performances from Patrick Beverley and Trevor Ariza and others. Even Harden was lighting it up from outside. But, you know, that was supposed to be the model that Miami was supposed to, you know, emulate. They were supposed to hit from outside, draw Harden away from the basket, Dwight Howard away from the basket, and instead they just crushed us inside, were able to feed the ball down low, and then kick it out to their shooters, who were just incredibly hot that night.
There's two things that happened in that Houston game, and it was Dwight Howard being way bigger and way better than anybody we can throw at him. There was nothing that they could have done systematically. Or even if Justin Hamilton played the best game of his life, there was just not going to be stopping Dwight Howard. Just physically, it was just not happening. So they had him, and I thought they did a good job, like, getting him away from the basket a lot on offense. But on, you know, when the Rockets are on offense, there's just nothing you can really do. And then the other thing that happened was Trevor Ariza was that third guy that stepped up for them, and the Heat didn't have a third guy that stepped up for them. And those two things, because, you know, the Rockets and the Heat, they're both power duos. You know, you got Wade and Bosch, power duo there, and Harden and Howard. So teams like that, they usually need a third guy to step up, and the Rockets had one, and Trevor Ariza hit 5 threes in that game, 2 in back-to-back in the fourth quarter that iced the game, and nobody really stepped up for the Heat.
You mean Justin Hamilton's 9 points and 3 three-pointers? You know, that's not a power player right there. You know,
did I give him an A? I think I gave him an A in my post-game grades.
That's weird. I never thought I'd hear the day.
Maybe a B+. I was happy. He had a career night, and I was like, you know what? This is his best game ever. I'm going to give this guy an A. It was more of a gold star than an A. I should have wrote that, just gold star.
Yeah, I mean, he's getting a lot of time just because Birdman and Haslam are out, right? But is he going to be a continued part of the rotation, you think?
That's a great question. Right before we started this podcast, I put a post up a little bit about, like, that kind of mentioned that. Just more about Chris Anderson and he's needing time to heal. And it just seems like indefinite right now with how long he's going to be out. And I don't know, because Spoelstra's weird. Like, but I don't know if this is the same kind of Spoelstra that we're going to be used to. If he's going to, these young guys are going to just kind of have a chance to be up and down. And in years past, when they were up and down, like when they were down, they were out of the lineup completely. And when they were up, they were getting 10 to 15 minutes a game sometimes. And you know, you think about guys like Michael Beasley, like, was the poster child for exactly that. And then, I don't know, dude. Like, does Anderson play 20 minutes again? You know, is 10 minutes in each half? Probably. But Hamilton is such a, like, the weird thing is Hamilton's so different than Anderson that it's almost, it might just depend on a matchup, you know? If they're looking to stretch the floor a little bit more, then put Hamilton in. Or if they're going up against a traditional center, then you're playing more Anderson. That might be it right there. What do you think?
And you can't overlook the fact that, you know, McRoberts has been hurt, Granger, right, who's another part of the rotation, has been out of it. So I mean, there's a lot of question marks here.
Somebody gets pushed out of this rotation, and I'm not sure who it is. But I'm starting to lean towards Granger. I just don't know if his only asset right now is 3-point shooting. If he doesn't have it, if he's cold, he could just sit. He could play the first, you know, he could play like 2 or 3 minutes and just not have it, and then just sit the rest of the game. And I don't know if he's going to be okay with that.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned it last night, but who would have thought that after starting 0-for-6, Sean Williams would be such a major part of the Heat offense? I mean, and he's looked pretty good. From a shooting perspective, he's been really, you know, nice. He's not great. He's certainly not Ray Allen. You don't expect him to hit, you know, 4 or 5 threes and get hot that way. But he's been consistent. He's been productive. And he's been a real find. Big surprise, I think. I don't think anybody saw him as being that kind of quality shooter. Did you?
No. You know what? And he's shooting 5, 6, 7 three-pointers a game. I mean, and they're mostly coming from the corner. And when they signed him, I kind of took a deep dive into his shot charts and his history and found that he's a really good corner three shooter. He was shooting like a really high percentage. I wish I could remember exactly what it was. But I'm pretty sure it was over like 40% from the corners. Like, it was like 42%, I want to say. That's a good percentage. And I really want to get into those, I don't know how far back they go, but those wide open corner three numbers that are on the tracker on NBA stats now. I kind of want to get into that and see where he was at in those numbers and, you know, wide open threes and stuff like that in years past. But he's been really good. And he's not doing anything crazy. He's just kind of sliding out and under the radar. He's just getting into the corner, almost like how Shane Battier did, would just end up in the corner and some, you know, the ball would whip around and eventually find him and he would just jack it up and that would be it. And he's hitting him and it's been awesome. He was almost written off in the preseason. Heat fans basically turned on him right away. I don't know why, but it was kind of like a we hate this guy kind of thing. And then all of a sudden he got good in the regular season. I've been really, really pleasantly surprised with him. I just don't know. He's playing a lot of minutes right now. Can he keep that same volume of three-point shooting up when McRoberts is getting 30 minutes a game and he's not?
Yeah, I don't see that being the case.
No, it's going to be very hard. And he's got to keep that percentage up too, which could be more difficult. You know, when you don't have all the practice chances.
He doesn't seem like he needs a lot of time to get going. You know, I think he hit a shot pretty early on in the game yesterday, and so maybe maybe he could come off the bench and just, you know, light it up from outside, be that kind of producer there. And then you're right, that forces Granger completely to the bench. I mean, what does he bring at that point? He's no longer a good defender. He can't drive to the hoop either. I mean, Williams is more athletic. I mean, that's, you know, within quote marks there, but I think he's a better package at this point in his career than Danny Granger is, unless he makes a complete and total turnaround, which we haven't seen in the preseason and we're not going to see anytime soon until he comes back from injury. So, you know, and it's funny too because, you know, Spoelstra changed things up, I guess, in order to keep Bosch from picking up foul trouble against Al Jefferson. He makes the questionable move of starting Williams on Jefferson on defense.
That was bad. That was bad. Did you see the video I posted in that? It was literally Al Jefferson got the ball in the post, turned around, and took two steps, like right in, like basically walked through Sean Williams and just like placed the ball into the basket. I mean, that was like his first points of the game. That was just, it was bad. That was ugly.
Yeah. I mean, Jefferson's so effective, though. And I mean, I don't know. I don't watch a lot of Charlotte games, and I haven't seen a lot of his career, but does he just have these kind of big games against Miami, or is it just that we have a particular deficiency there? Because he just seems to, like, slaughter us. I mean, going back to, like, LeBron 60-whatever game last season, you know, overlooked was the fact that he had, what, 40 points or something like that? I mean, he was really killing us.
He was a big part. Yeah, there's a reason why they're building their team around Al Jefferson, basically. But I wish I remember who tweeted this out, but somebody said something like, if Al Jefferson played the Heat every game, he'd be better than Michael Jordan. it was a season high in points. He had a great game. It's just, yeah, he eats up the Heat. That's because they don't have a traditional center, and they've kind of avoided that. They've took chances in the past, but nobody's really worked out, and I think it's a huge void on this team. And in the playoffs, you know, in the last 4 years, LeBron just had this greatness about him that was just able to bail out the Heat. And LeBron combined with Wade and Bosch, they were just collectively were just so good together that they were able to overcome such a huge mismatch because just their greatness was even a bigger mismatch than it was, you know, for the Pacers or the Bulls or anybody like that. So, but they don't have that this year, you know what I mean? So and they barely were getting past the Bulls and barely getting past the Pacers, and without LeBron they're not getting past those teams. Maybe the Pacers aren't a factor this year, but you know, you're looking ahead a couple years now and they'll be back in it. And so they need a real big man, and I don't think that they can ignore it.
But I mean, we keep going back to those same options that are available. I don't know that any of them are that significant an upgrade. I mean, I know in your piece you mentioned, you know, waiting for Emeka Okafor or maybe waiting for Andre Blatch if he's willing to come back from China or something like that. But, I mean, do you think it's viable that they would be a substantial upgrade? I know that that there's a weakness there. So do you fill it with one of those guys, not knowing whether or not they're going to be substantially better or maybe the same as what we have currently on the roster? Or do you just say, well, you know what, we know that we have this weakness. We have to strengthen everything else and minimize that kind of weakness and the impact it has on our, you know, our chances of making the postseason, et cetera.
I wonder if Josh McRoberts can fill that role. I don't know if that's the best use of his time, so to speak. But they really, you know, I like Aaron Gray. He was waived and has not been picked up yet. Just for a few minutes a game, just throw him out there. Just to make sure that Dwight Howard and Al Jefferson and those kind of guys don't just keep walking right towards the basket. Just throw them in there for a few minutes. They don't need a starter. They don't need even a guy that's going to play Chris Anderson minutes. And Chris Anderson, by the way, I mean, that's not the answer. I think that he's just going to continue to digress. I mean, he's got the ribs thing. He didn't look good necessarily in the preseason. I mean, I don't know. I mean, you know, the answer is they missed out on their chance, and it was Greg Steemsma. I'm sorry. That was the opportunity, and they didn't go and sign Greg Steemsma. As many times as I wrote his name in all caps, they didn't go and do it. And that was the big mistake. You have a giant Greg Steemsma-shaped German cloud hanging over the Heat for the rest of the season.
A German cloud? That sounds like some kind of chemical warfare there. I don't know. Is he thriving over in Toronto? I don't know that he has.
He came in the Heat game. The Heat Raptors game for like a few minutes and didn't really do anything and then just went back to the bench. But it was beautiful every second of it, and I just kept imagining like that red slightly changing into a different shade of red into a Heat red. That's just all I wanted. I just wanted Greg Snemsma.
If you squint your eyes just right, maybe it looks like he's wearing a Heat jersey.
I'll say this. I think that Blatch isn't happening. I think he's going to love China. I think he's going to be there for the rest of his career. I don't think he ever comes back to the NBA. I think he's going to score like 30 points a game and just love it there. And he's just going to absolutely fall in love with the culture. And that's going to be it. That's my prediction for Andre Blatch. And nobody's going to miss him. And then Emeka Okafor, I don't know. I think, like you mentioned on a prior podcast, like, yeah, it's easy enough to say like that he could go get him. But does he even pick the Heat? Like, that's not a foregone conclusion already, like it was in the LeBron James era, where it's just like, oh, we want him. Yeah, he'll sign with us because we have LeBron James. You know, he could have a million other or well 29 other suitors, you know, maximum. But yeah, I think there's guys out there. You just got to throw them out there. Just big bodies. That's the problem. They don't need anybody great. They don't need anybody even good. Not even average. They just need a guy that just fits the size of a traditional center, because these guys, it was just unbelievable. It was such a glaring weakness that Al Jefferson can just put his arm up over Justin Hamilton and Sean Williams, and Dwight Howard can do the same thing. They just need a guy that's just bigger.
Is Rashard Lewis the answer then? I don't know.
Jermaine O'Neal's available. There's a little part of me that still thinks that could be something.
No.
No.
Although he gave good minutes for the Warriors last year. I know you watched him play a lot, so.
Yeah, I mean, he has his moments. I think he's still capable of like an 18-point game or something, but no, it's something that they're going to have to address. And then there's always Kim Birch.
That's my pick.
I think that's my pick too. And if Andre Dawkins isn't going to play at all, which he hasn't, maybe you just kind of swap him. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's a good move, because I think, you know, I was talking about this earlier, you know, Hamilton, nice player. I mean, certainly his shooting has been, you know, not surprising, because I know that's what he brings to the table, and it's a nice touch and everything else, but he's just not physical enough to contend. And I know that Kim, you know, he needs a lot of growth offensively, but defensively, at least the effort's there. I think he might pick up, you know, a number of fouls in a few minutes, but you know what? So what? At least he'll limit a player's effectiveness and, you know, just being able to bully us the way that, you know, Howard did and Jefferson did. So, and maybe you look at it another way though, and this is a possibility. How many players are there that have that kind of power and skill that could, you know, effectively control Miami the way those two did?
Exactly.
Maybe it's just something you say, you know what, we're going to have that weakness, we overlook it, and then maybe we'll just focus on our perimeter defense, which has been a glaring weakness as well, though. And I know that's something else that's been a problem for Miami because of our rotations and our defensive schemes and whatnot, but it seems like a lot of guys are hitting those outside shots and normally they might not, so that's a problem. And especially when we're going to be facing more prolific shooting teams, like, say, a Dallas or Cleveland at some point in the future if they ever get it going. So it's something to consider as far as, you know, what you want to focus on. And Spoelstra, from what I've seen as the way he's managed this team and looked at who he substituted in and out, he seems to have a very good grasp more than ever of what a player brings to the table, and he's willing to manage those minutes more effectively. He knows what he's going to get. He doesn't have to say, well, I'm just going to leave LeBron in there for 40, and then whoever else comes in and out, that's who I'm going to play. I think he's a lot more structured in his substitutions, and I know that's something you and I have talked about in the past, that maybe it seems kind of, you know, random, like, oh, this guy's going to play, this guy doesn't play for 2 weeks then, and, you know, I think he's a lot more aware of who he can bring in and what they're going to do, and that's great. It's great to see him evolve and be more aware of a team's limitations and maximize a player's abilities. I know that sounds like, you know, double speak or whatever, but I think that's what he's doing. I think he's looking at what a player brings to the table, and we, you know, we notice that in the way he's used Napier in crunch time minutes. I mean, he did it against Charlotte, so it's something to consider.
Yeah, a couple things about what you said. You're absolutely right, and I think that's, and Spoelstra knows that about big guys. They're going to have to concede that that's just a physical mismatch, but at the same time, Pat Riley did try to find centers. I just don't think he found one that he liked enough to pay money for. And they tried Chris Johnson, and he lasted, what, three preseason games, and that was it. And, like, never, like, played one game, I think. That was it. And then, but there is a need there. And it's weird because they did have traditional centers on the roster in the past, and this is, like, the first year where they didn't even take a risk on a guy. So, but, yeah, there's not enough of those guys to warrant making a big trade or necessarily spending a lot of money on somebody. They're going to be able to win. They can win 50 games with this roster if they play to the best that they can. This is a 50-win team. I'm not saying they will, but, like, you know, best case scenario. It's just the playoffs, because all those guys in the playoffs, the Hornets are going to be there, the Bulls are going to be there. If the goal is to advance in the playoffs, they need somebody that they could throw out there for a few minutes at a time. But back to Shabazz Napier, I cannot believe how much I love that guy already. Like, I am all in on the Napier train. I might buy a number 13 jersey. I probably won't do that, but I'm all in on Shabazz Napier. There's one play that blew my mind, and the Heat didn't even score on the play. Last night against the Hornets, third quarter. It was the lineup where Chalmers and Napier are in, and Bosch was on the floor too.
Yeah.
And so Chalmers is bringing the ball up, because you know that, like, when Chalmers and Napier are on the court together, they do more of the, like, that Phoenix Suns combo guard thing, like, just they kind of switch off who's bringing the ball up. And so on this particular play, Chalmers brought the ball up, and Napier, one thing about Napier before I continue with the rest of his play, I don't know if he necessarily knows where he's supposed to be on offense sometimes. He kind of crowds the spacing a little bit. He kind of, like, follows other guys a little bit. He could space the floor a little bit more. I'm not sure he always knows where he's supposed to be, but that's fine. He's a rookie. Anyway, he's kind of near Chalmers, and then he kind of drifts away, and then it looked like he almost, like, shouted at Chalmers, not yelling, just kind of tried to get his attention, and, like, kind of, like, motioned him to give him the ball, and that happened within a half second. So Chalmers gave him the ball, and then Napier immediately passed it to a cutting Chris Bosh on the baseline, who ended up missing the shot. But it was just, that was Napier seeing the development of the play a step ahead of everybody else on the floor, and he knew Chalmers wasn't going to see that, and he said, I need the ball so I can make this pass. And so often you see people, like, ask for the ball so they can get into an ISO or do something with the ball, but he just wanted to get the ball to pass the ball. And I thought that was just, like, brilliant. And the Heat didn't even score on the play, but it blew me away. I was like, how did he see that coming? He knew we needed to pass it to Bosch because it was just the best opportunity for the Heat to score on that play. And it was an awesome, and I was just like, wow, that was great.
Who was guarding Bosch at the time? Maybe that was a big part of it.
I don't remember. I have to go back and watch.
It was probably Zeller. Because Zeller was that energy boost last night for Charlotte. But you kept seeing Chris Bosch try to kind of force it a little bit. And that, you know, he assumed that, well, I got Zeller on me, I'm going to go ahead and be able to take advantage of this mismatch. And it didn't work out a whole hell of a lot of time. He bumped into Zeller, or Zeller was able to strip him and then, you know, not necessarily get anything going. But he kept forcing it and forcing it and forcing it. It just didn't work out. So maybe I guess, you know, Napier saw that there was a mismatch there and wanted to feed him the ball because he was being particularly aggressive or something like that. But, I mean, that's a big part of it. And maybe that's why he's getting those kind of clutch minutes over Cole, is that there is a court awareness there. There is an understanding of how the player or how the play is shaping up one and two steps ahead of everybody else. And that's what a point guard needs to do. It's not what Chalmers ever been able to do. And it's not what, you know, Cole can currently do. So it's good to see that Napier is able to do that. It's just, I mean, if he was able to hit that outside shot with consistency, we wouldn't even be having this conversation. I don't know how they would manage Cole at that point. But, you know, Napier has been able to do everything but score effectively. And I figure that's just a matter of time before that becomes part of his game.
Yeah. And he's been pretty good off ball. Like, he's gotten a couple passes go his way, and he drained a corner or a three-pointer or just a kind of a mid-range two. He's done a couple things off the ball, and he seems almost more he seems better shooting the ball, like, as a spot-up shooter than he is just, like, off the dribble right now. But yeah, you're right, that's something that he's, and once that's consistent and improves with him, no doubt. And, you know, it doesn't even have to be consistent, it just needs to be better than Cole and Chalmers, which isn't that big of a threshold there. So once he's better than Cole and Chalmers in that regard, then he'll probably be the starter. I just don't know when that will be.
You see it happening sometime this season, though. You think that?
Yeah.
I mean, okay. Because to me, like the whole situation and his contract and everything else, I see that being such a major motivation behind how they manage him and you know, mm-hmm. keep his minutes going and everything else. I don't know that they can afford to put Napier in as a starter. Either you're going to keep Cole as a starter because, you know, he's going to either play up to his potential and then you get quality minutes at the point guard position, and then maybe he plays himself off of the roster because, you know, his contract demands exceed what Miami's willing to give him, and then he moves on to another team, but at least you have Napier who can fill in for him next season. Or he increases his value this year and then you use him as a valuable trade chip, but you can't just put him in there as a starter and then yank him. I mean, what the hell do I know? But if you yank him and demote him, then he neither has value as a potential starter this year, or does he have value as a trade chip either. So I don't see right. the point in yanking him out of the starting lineup anytime soon.
It doesn't really matter. It's just who closes the games, and Napier's closing the games now. But also, to your point, to answer your question more detailed, I think Napier starts games this year. I just don't know if he keeps the starting job this year. It's either going to be injury or just experimentation or matchup or something, but I think Napier does start at least one game this year.
Okay. I mean, I can concede that.
Yes.
That seems logistical, but as far as keeping it, I don't know. Given the contract situation and everything that it entails, I just don't know that.
And the rotation issue, because Cole, if you're bringing Cole off the bench, because right now they like what I was saying with Napier and Chalmers, they like that combo guard. Cole and Chalmers did it last year, but it wasn't necessarily that effective, or it didn't really suit their strengths as much as it just kind of suited pushing the pace and having faster guys on the floor in general. But in terms of their specific strengths, they didn't really complement each other that much. But I think Napier and Chalmers do, because Chalmers has been instructed score first. Napier looks naturally pass first, and I think that's a good combination there. And then, so I think it's just easier to have Cole as the starter. He's not playing so poorly that he needs to be benched anyway. And like I said, it's who finishes the games. And Napier is getting crunch time minutes, and it just seems like he's the point guard at the end of games, and that's completely fine.
Yeah, they went with that weird hybrid lineup last night where they had, you know, Cole, Chalmers, and Wade.
I love that one. I like the either the Cole, Chalmers, Wade or the Napier, Chalmers, Wade. I really, really like it. I like the three guard thing. I mean, it blew up in their face against the Rockets because Wade just couldn't defend Trevor Ariza. Like, Ariza was just like darting around screens and he was just bigger and just got shots up over Wade, and it blew up in their face. But over the long haul, I just really like three guard lineups, and I think over the long run of the season, it's gonna be a good thing for them.
Speaking of Ariza, what about Luol Deng? I mean, he hasn't done much.
He's done exactly what he is supposed to be doing. I think he scores 12 to 15 points a game, gets you like 5-6 rebounds a game. That's what he is. He keeps the small forward position to being a black hole of awfulness. He keeps it somewhat consistent. He's not going to be the third guy. I don't know why. He was never going to be the third guy. He just never has been. He wasn't with the Bulls. You know, as much as they want him to be, just wasn't. And he's just not that guy. He's a solid player. He's going to give you defensive effort every night, and he's been good defensively. He's been one of the few good guys on the wing, right? I mean, you know, it's going to be Chalmers making his shots. Chalmers is shooting them. They just need to fall. So it's either going to be Chalmers starting to make shots, Cole scoring 23 points a game, which doesn't seem likely, or somebody else stepping up. What do you think about Deng?
I'm disappointed, you know, because I think that he's got it all there. A lot of shots, you know, he attacks the rim. A lot of the shots should have fallen. Mm-hmm. You know, every time he puts up a jumper, I'm thinking, is this the right shot for him? And then it looks like it could fall, and then it caroms off, and it's, you know, he's taking a couple of air balls. It's just like, it's so hard to predict because I know he's more skilled than them, but he's looked shaky. And he also seems like he's perpetually hurt, too. Like, I think, you know, he's overcome whatever major injuries he's had, but he was whacked across the arm and, you know, hurt wrist. You know, he just looks like he's pushing through it. And that's great because, you know, as a fan or whatever, you like that kind of grit and that intensity or whatever. Maybe that's the Chicago model, you know, where everybody pushes through it, but it's not effective. You know, he's not being an effective player. I mean, it's one thing to say, like you did, that, you know, he's just not going to be able to produce as much, but there's always a feeling that he could produce more. And he just doesn't seem like he's able to because of these, you know, lingering injuries, and he's just not, it's not, you know, pulling together in a way that's deserving of a player with his athletic ability and his talent overall. I think he's gone to some good spots. He's cut to the lane well. The outside shot, I mean, maybe he's just, maybe, you know, this is just the player he's always been, and there is no room for growth even at this point in his career.
He's a very streaky outside shooter, and he always has been. I mean, there was just games where he'd be in Chicago and he would just kill us when he was hot. And then when he was cold, it was almost like you forget he's on the court. It's like, I say this all the time about Luol Deng. Oh, wow, he played 34 minutes tonight? I had no idea. You just kind of forget about him. I think partly, and it's not his fault, but they don't really run plays for him. You know, they run plays for McRoberts when he's in. They ran plays for every play is run through Bosch. They're running plays for, you know, ISO post-ups or Wade. They even run plays for Sean Williams, getting him in the corner, you know, with some off-ball screen action and stuff like that. But not really anything, like Deng, you mentioned, like he'll cut to the basket. That's all him. That's just timing a good cut and somebody finding him. I don't know if that's necessarily a ran play, but I don't really think that's really a primary concern for them, just because it's like, okay, we want to run a play for Deng, but I don't know if that's his strength as a play ran for him, because he's not a good outside shooter. So he's kind of just like a savvy guy. He knows when to cut to the basket. He's a supplemental player.
Yeah. A couple of points I was going to mention. Okay. You mentioned, you brought up McRoberts. Okay, one, what's your take on the whole being booed aspect in Charlotte last night? And secondly, what do you think about the whole jersey situation? Because I see that as having gotten a lot more traction than it deserved, but I mean, I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are.
The ripped jersey situation?
Yes.
Okay. My take on the boos, first of all, the Charlotte Hornets, those Charlotte fans, they don't really know how to handle basketball right now. It's not, they hadn't had a basketball team, and then they got one, and like McRoberts is like the first good player to leave. You know what I mean? And he was like average, yeah. I guess, like above average. So like, I guess they don't really know what to do when a former player returns. So they just booed him.
I was hearing the Charlotte's broadcast on League Pass. I don't know if you were watching the same thing, but they brought up...
I'm loyal to Eric Reed and Tony Florentino, David.
Yeah, so am I. online, the only one I could get was the Charlotte broadcast. But anyway, they were mentioning how, you know, McRoberts took a similarly valued contract in Miami to what Charlotte was offering him, and the presumption is that he took the deal in Miami because he thought when he agreed to it that LeBron was coming back. And it was a big part of his decision-making process why he chose the same amount of money to go to Miami. When LeBron decided he wasn't coming back to Miami, it was kind of an F you to Charlotte, saying, well, you know what, I just don't feel like going back to Charlotte anyway. So I think that's kind of why the fans are as upset as they are. I just thought I'd bring that up.
Oh, that's an interesting point. Yeah, I hadn't heard that, so...
Yeah, I guess there was a sense of disloyalty or whatever, especially because he was so beloved.
Get over it. We lost LeBron James. You lost Josh McRoberts. Get over it, Charlotte. Jesus.
Yeah, so about the ripped jersey thing, I guess a lot of people are kind of like, it's kind of like a mockery, you know, how he ripped his shirt and then you're calling him the Hulk and all that. But I guess that's just the player he is. He's kind of like out of control and intense, and I kind of love it, and I'm feeling like maybe whether or not I should or shouldn't. I'm starting to question myself a little bit about it because, you know, it seems kind of goofy. You know, a lot of players get frustrated and they'll rip their jersey, and he's clearly not the most powerful player on the court. But just for him to go and show that, you know, by ripping his jersey, you know, how am I supposed to feel about this, I think, is the question. Because I kind of like it, and I kind of feel like, wow, this is a guy who's really into it. It was a stupid play, too. I don't even remember what it was exactly.
Didn't he miss a free throw or something?
No, I think it was a defensive rotation that he threw and led to a foul or something like that. And he's like, I'm pissed off.
It was something with free throws, I thought. Because I remember like free throws being shot like after or something.
He got taken out immediately afterwards. And he had to because he had to replace the jersey or whatever. But.
So, All right. I thought it was awesome when it happened. I thought it was like, wow, I don't see that all the time. That was very entertaining. And that was like the only thing I thought about it. And next thing I know, it's like blowing up on Twitter and like videos are being posted of it. I'm like, all right, hell, I should probably put a click whore post on All You Can Heat about it. And I did. And it got a bunch of traffic and whatever. So my thing is his comments after said he didn't mean to rip the jersey. And I don't believe that for a second. I mean, I probably watched that video way too much more than I should have, because after he made those comments, I'm like, wait a minute. And I watched the video over and over and over and over again, and there is absolutely no way that that was an accident. There is absolutely no way at all that that was an accident. And I don't know why he lied about it, but he did. But he intentionally ripped that jersey. He ripped it, and he stopped, and he didn't look surprised when it ripped. It was like, it was more of a mission accomplished face. I ripped the jersey. This is what I was sent here to do. And that was it. And why he would lie about it, I don't know. I don't know if there's like a fine involved if you intentionally rip your jersey or something, but I don't know.
An interesting take on it. Yeah, because maybe he kind of sensed that there would be some, you know, backlash or something like that.
Right. Like sure like vandalism of like league property or something. Like, I don't even know.
Yeah. Oh, or that it could set off like a, maybe the coaches told him, hey, we don't want this becoming a trend where all of a sudden people start ripping their jerseys.
Oh man. Maybe Adam Silver said when you're asked about this, say it was an accident, because if this goes viral, if this becomes a thing, and now we got like Blake Griffin in LA ripping his jersey in half, like we can't do this.
Yeah, and it seems a lot more fitting for somebody like Griffin, who's like, you know, a horse, you know, being able to rip his jersey, and he never has, and he's been frustrated plenty of times. That's I know it's a Heat podcast, but I wanted to bring it up and maybe have a different take on it. But his comments a couple of weeks ago or something like that he was going to take any kind of, you know, fighting or crap or anything like that. That, I mean, I hate to use profanity, but that's horseshit, right? I mean, he's not a tough guy. He's just talking a lot of talk, right?
He's in such a difficult situation because he's like that all-star, you know, he's got all the attention on him now that if he just straight up punches a guy in the face, he can lose sponsors. You know what I mean? Like he could lose, like that's something that you have to think about when you're in that kind of situation. But if you're a guy like, I don't know, DeMarcus Cousins, who I don't know if he has any sponsorships, like I don't even see him, like I don't live in Sacramento, but I live like close to Sacramento. I don't see him on commercials or anything. I don't know. But like he could just punch a guy in the face. Like Blake has got a lot more, I think, on the line. He's in a tough situation, and I've kind of gone back and forth between this, if he's actually a tough guy or if he's just acting like it or if he's kind of got his hands tied. But he also takes like a lot of hits, like a lot of unnecessary like hits. And it's almost like he takes so many hard fouls that the refs can't call it a hard foul or a flagrant every single time it happens. Or even just a regular foul, because he just gets hit all the time. So I don't know. I see a lot of Clippers games because I'm still up on the West Coast. Like, so I watch almost every Clippers game or Warriors game, just because I'm still up. But it's noticeable how many hard fouls he gets. Okay. So I don't know. I don't know. It's hard for me to judge. But I go back and forth on this thing.
No, it's a good point because I.
But to answer your question, it is horseshit because he has to take the brute. He has to take all that stuff. He's not gonna be able to. He can't do anything about it.
But at least maybe then there's like. You know, he's a pretty sharp guy, at least that's what I gathered from, you know, hearing him and reading some of what he's written in the past and his comments, etc. So he seems like he's sharp enough, and maybe this is his way of saying, look, I'm aware of it, and I don't like it, so don't feel like you can just come up to me and start whacking and hitting me inappropriately, you know. So maybe this is his only recourse, and is to make these public, ridiculous comments just to say, you know, I'm not going to take it anymore. Maybe people will be aware of it. And it's also, you know, brings it to the attention of referees. Not that his, you know, incessant whining doesn't do that also, but, you know, maybe just for the public's sake, maybe this is just another way of bringing attention to something that you've noticed. So I'm glad you brought it up because you watch a lot more Clippers games. But, you know, it's interesting, and I know I'm digressing like crazy, but I think that's the nature of this podcast. You know, it's so interesting watching more games on League Pass than I ever have. Like 2 years ago, I never watched games from League Pass. I didn't have to, and now that I'm covering the team, it's something that I felt is necessary. Mm-hmm. But the difference in commercials, there's a real. This is probably like a good post somewhere. I don't know if it's already been written up or if I'm giving somebody a hell of an idea. But I could see, you know, a very lengthy piece on like the style and like how it defines a city. Based on the commercials that you see during League Pass, they are so different. You watch a Miami broadcast, and there is like an infusion of ethnicity to it that you will not get in a Pacers broadcast, let me tell you. Those cut-and-dried commercials, the way they use their players as far as like being spokesperson for your local sub shop or pizza place or anything like that, you don't get that in Miami. I don't know if it's Miami because we're so glitzy or because we're so flashy or what have you, but it's just a huge stylistic difference.
Well, you have a lot of like amateur and like semi-pro filmmakers in like Miami and LA and stuff like that are probably doing those commercials, where in Indiana, you don't go to Indiana saying, I'm going to Indiana, I'm going to be a filmmaker, I'm going to be the next big director. So I think that's a lot to do with it. It's just like the client base that you're working with when you're hiring directors for these commercials. That's my theory. I don't know.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I could go on for hours, and I have. Yeah. I've like bored people to death. Like my family, who doesn't care about anything outside of what's happening in Miami and only peripherally. You know, I talk to them and tell them, "Oh my God, you should see what Sacramento Kings commercials are like," and they have no idea what the hell I'm talking about. And they don't know why I'm bothering to bring up the stylistic differences of what's going on in Kingsland. But it is such an interesting thing for me because again, I think actually the Heat commercials are so polished and it's just completely different. And then all of a sudden you see like this commercial that looks like it costs $10 and your Uncle Bud's video camera to record with, you know, George Hill going into your local branch of Federal Union Bank or whatever the hell it is. It's unbelievable. And every time the commercials come on, I know I should be flipping on to watch another game or something like that, but I'm just like mesmerized by how they use like Ben McLemore to advertise the pizza guys in Sacramento or something like that.
You know what? You know what the weirdest thing is? I'm glad you brought this up because it's something I've noticed as well. But the really weird thing is the car commercials, even when they don't have basketball players in them. But yes. Growing up in Miami, there's certain guys like, you know, the mafias that run the car dealerships or whatever, that you just get used to hearing certain names. Like, what are some of the popular names in Miami, the ones that they always advertise? It's been a couple of years, but...
Gus Machado.
Yeah, like that one. Like, all those guys, like... And then out here in the Bay Area, it's just like complete. It's just a bunch of Asian names and like it's the completely different like thing. And you just have like it's still broken English. It's just a different kind of broken English. And it's the weirdest thing is the car dealership commercials. It's like you get used to hearing certain names like literally your entire life that are like advertising the Dolphins games, the Heat games, just all the time. And it's completely different.
Last point on this before I bore everybody who's listening to death. Like, I was watching the Hornets broadcast, and Ron Rivera, the head coach for the Carolina Panthers, is advertising, you know, your local Charlotte area Mercedes-Benz dealer.
Wow.
And I'm trying to think if anybody would even recognize in Miami who the hell Joe Philbin is, or if that would, like, that would probably...
Or if you even buy a car from Joe Philbin.
Yeah, exactly. If he advertises it, wouldn't you... more apt not to buy the car he drives because it's too sensible and doesn't go for it on fourth down, or, you know, because he makes the bad decision. It's like, oh, no thanks. That one probably goes 0-60 in 10 hours. So I'm not going to buy it if Joe Philbin does it. But it was funny. There were back-to-back commercials of Ron Rivera advertising Mercedes-Benz and then, like, the Panthers Defensive Player of the Year advertising your alarm system. I don't even know who this guy is.
Luke Kuechly?
Yeah, I guess that's it. Okay, sorry. You know who he is. You know a lot more than I do about NFL football. So he's advertising your alarm systems. It's, you know, if you want to protect your home, if you want to defend your home, go with blankety blank, you know, alarm systems. I'm just like, what the hell is this? These commercials, it's amazing. You could go on for hours. I will. I shouldn't anymore. So I said my piece.
And would you buy a car from Eric Spoelstra?
Yes. Yes, I think I would.
I think I would too. I wonder what kind of car he would sell. Philbin would sell the Ford Fusion. Not even, like, absolutely. And Spoelstra is selling, like, I think he sells, like, something cool. I don't know.
But not too cool. Like, right. He's done his research, you know. Like an Acura, maybe.
Yeah, he's not going to go out and say, you should totally buy the Dodge Charger. Like, he's not. Spoelstra knows better than that. But, maybe like a BMW. Like a right. Like one of the sports series or something.
Yeah, he has like a whole team of guys that has like, you know, called video and done all the statistics on it and lots of analysis. And then he comes up with like an 800-page report and finally just says, you know what, I'm going to stick with my 1992 whatever. He's trying.
Yeah. All right. If anybody else is listening to this podcast now, thoughts on Chris Bosh?
I mean, I think he's going to bounce back. I think, you know, he had a very good game against Charlotte. You know, some of the shots that he had been hitting that first week he missed last night, but I think that'll change. Against Minnesota, I personally think he's going to have a field day. I don't think they defend very well. I think he's going to be matched up against, what, Pekovic maybe, or Thad Young in any case. So either way, I think it's a matchup that's an advantage for him, and I think he's going to feast on it. So I see him going back to the production he had week one, and I think he'll continue to be the MVP-style player that we've seen in the first week and will continue to see throughout most of the season.
Yeah, I want to look ahead to that Timberwolves game. You know, in our look ahead little piece at the end, but Gorgui Dieng worries me. I like him a lot. I've always liked him since Louisville, and he's just kind of he's bouncy, young, athletic guy that can give Bosch some fits. But overall, I think Chris Bosch is just doing exactly what I thought we hoped he would do. He's setting things up from the elbow. He's driving. He's shooting. He's not a decoy anymore. He is actively affecting the offense and almost dictating what happens with his decisions. He's almost the quarterback. You know, he gets the ball in the elbow, he decides what he wants to do with it, and so many of the plays that run for him, I'm working on a piece a little bit about like the different kind of plays that they're running for him, or rather through him, I should probably say. I think he's the kind of player that can handle that. He's smart. He gets the game. He's seen it from a different perspective, which I think is a really big deal. He's seen it from basically standing at the three-point line the last year and a half. And then before that, just basically standing on the perimeter. And, I just think, like, there's so many things that he learned the last 4 years that are really starting to take place here that just give him a certain perspective and awareness on the court. I think he's just... I still think he makes... If he continues this, he'll be on the All-NBA team, of like the first or second team All-NBA, because I think he's just been absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah, you're right. And to your point, I mean, you know, I wrote about it last week, I think, about his increased leadership and, just the level of introspection from him and how he kind of sees things. He's so sharp, so intelligent. I mean, I love him. And
I really like that piece because it really pointed out something like, Miami's leader the last 4 years was LeBron James, right? And it was just like this marketing-driven facade, basically. And this is what you wrote. And this is like, and now like the team's leader is more organic. There's a culture, like a new culture around the team that's just more organic, more down to earth. It's just like I use this phrase before the season: bare bones basketball, and that's what it is. It's just like, this is basketball. Chris Bosh really likes playing basketball. All these guys are just about basketball, and like, well, you know, and like ties. Apparently, everybody's really into neckties. But other than that, like, it's basketball.
Yeah.
And I love it.
Yeah. No. Absolutely. I concur 100%.
All right. Let's look ahead a little bit. Minnesota, Saturday, 7:30 p.m. Eastern time. Talked about it a little bit. I'm excited to see Andrew Wiggins.
Yeah.
I haven't really gotten much chance to watch him yet.
Me neither. I'm looking forward to it. I'm going to have to watch a couple of games between now and then because I think they're an interesting team. And I mean, I know that's, you know, they're going through something similar as far as losing their best player or what have you, but there's a lot of faith there with lowered expectations that, you know, there's going to be a very good team in the future. So I'm excited to see what can happen in Minnesota and what they think, you know, from a fan's perspective, what they think the ceiling is there, because it should be a very good team in the future. It might be frustrating in the next, you know, year or two, but I think there's good pieces in place there, so it should be really good. Oh, plus, I also think that they're totally serial, by the way. I don't know if you thought about it or not, but I think they're 100% serial.
100% serial, and I'll take you a step further. They are honeycombs. They are just 100% honeycomb serial, and I don't know why, but they are. They just feel like honeycombs. I'm excited. The Heat could lose that game because Minnesota is one of those teams that's either they're going to be just rock bottom bad or kind of decent. And if the Heat don't see them, expect them being decent, that's a trap game because the next game is a back-to-back against Dallas in Dallas. So I'm worried about Minnesota as a trap game because that Dallas game, the Heat are looking at that game. Chris Bosh, Dwayne Wade, they have history with Dirk. Luckily, J.J. Barea is not there, but Barea's with Minnesota. If Barea goes off, I'm going to be pissed. I don't like him. But I
mean, are they really looking ahead? Do you really think so? Or have you seen anything to imply that they're looking ahead?
I know it makes sense. It's a back-to-back. It's over the weekend. They get Minnesota at home, and then they have to go to Dallas. I think that's a trap game. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. I mean, they've been good. They've been good with the perspective. I just worry about it just because of the nature of the Timberwolves and just the fact that Dallas is the game after and Dallas is a good team.
So yeah, I'm kind of overselling it. Yeah, no, maybe my point is that I think they'll focus completely on Minnesota, probably counting on losing to Dallas just because I just don't think they match up very well at this point. So, but maybe it's the exact opposite. So,
well, I think they win the Dallas game. I think they go undefeated in the weekend. Yep.
That's bold. Man, I'm impressed.
All right. I'm predicting two wins. That's a bold prediction. I'm excited for the Dallas game, though. I've gotten a chance to watch a couple of Mavericks games, and they're a lot of fun. And I don't know if they're a mismatch, though, because I think if McRoberts is healthy by then, he could do a decent enough job on Dirk, but Dirk's going to get his either way. It's just making it difficult for him, and McRoberts has the athleticism to do that. And then Bosch, I don't know. Tyson Chandler isn't Tyson Chandler that he was 3 years ago.
Right.
And then there's Monte Ellis, and I think that the Heat's guards, defensively it's not going to be pretty, but the Heat's guards could probably take advantage of Monte a little bit, you know, on their side. That'll be a good game. I think it'll be an interesting game. I think those two teams, they match up well against each other for an exciting game. And I don't know if we'll see when we do the next pod next week, but Wednesday is Indiana. And unfortunately for ESPN, they decided to air that one on national television. So that's going to be a nationally televised game, Indiana, Wednesday night.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, well, they've already stuck with their 118 Lakers broadcast, so it makes sense that they're going to have Miami and Indiana, especially at a point where Indiana is broken as much as they are. But, you know, maybe is it at Indiana or is it at Miami?
It's in Miami.
Yeah, because, I mean, that was the one edge that the Pacers might have. If it was at home, maybe in front of their crowd, they're still willing to kind of show that there's a rivalry or something there. But no, if it's at Miami, it's just a lost cause.
I think the Heat are just going to kill them in that game. And it's not even Indiana's fault, but I think just the fact that the Heat and the Pacers like had so many tough battles in the past, the Heat just want to like bury the hatchet in this one. They just want to say, you know what, Indiana's not a threat to us this year. Let's just kill them and show them that. And so what did I just predict three straight wins?
I think you did, man.
I think I did. But Friday is at Atlanta, and we're going to lose that one. So there we go.
That's for next week's podcast.
Right.
We'll predict three straight losses then.
So this was an optimistic podcast. This is just how we kind of go. Oh, Dallas, cereal or not cereal? That's a tough one. Not cereal? I don't know.
I don't think so.
I'm hedging a little bit on that one. But we both agree Indiana's not even close to cereal, right? I don't even know if they sell cereal in Indiana.
No,
I think they just eat like cream of wheat there.
Yeah, but like really dull. They don't add anything to it. I mean, it's just
like cinnamon flavor.
Yeah.
All right, I'll get back to you on the Dallas thing. I'm not sure how cereal they are. Is there like a in between? I don't know, like dry cereal.
Oatmeal? Does that count? I don't know.
Oatmeal with like little dinosaur eggs.
Yes, all shaped like Dirk Nowitzki or like Run DMC or whatever.
There we go. That's Dallas. That's the Dallas Mavericks. Oh, Mark Cuban's face.
Oh,
pop
no.
out of dinosaur eggs. There we go. That's exactly what happens, actually. Who invents the Chris Bosh oatmeal, by the way? Dinosaur eggs that hatch Chris Bosh faces.
I think you just did.
Did I just invent that? There we go. All right. Well, this is the Heat Check. Thanks for joining me, David. Anything else you want to add before we go?
No, I think it's been an exciting week, and I'm very happy to be part of the Heat Check broadcast.
So am I.
Oh, and don't forget to test drive your local area at Mercedes-Benz.
Yeah, definitely do that, and don't buy anything from Joe Philbin ever. This is the Heat Check. Thanks for listening. Find us on iTunes. I swear this time we're on iTunes. No technical difficulties. Just search Heat Check and subscribe and rate us. Say nice things about us because it's very important to us. And check out allyoucanheat.com. That's where you can find my writing. You can find David's writing. It's all really great. All post-game and pre-game stuff and everything in between. Thanks for listening.
Ace is the place with the helpful hardware, folks.
It's Ace's biggest LED light bulb sale of the year. Right now, buy one, get one free on our best-selling LED light bulbs. Our 4-pack of LED bulbs is $9.99, and our 2-pack of LED floodlights is only $12.99. Buy one, get one free. There's no limit on how much you can save, so stock up now. Hurry in. Buy one, get one free on long-lasting 10-year LED bulbs, now through Monday, only at your neighborhood Ace. See participating stores for details.